It's The Guardian.
Regid Ahmed here on Gadigal Land. For bonus listening in your feed, here's political reporter Josh Butler and columnist Peter Lewis discussing the latest results in the Guardian Essential poll, which show more gains for Pauline Hanson.
I'm Josh Butler, political reporter and chief of staff at Guardian Australia. I'm coming to you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people in Canberra. It's the Guardian Essential edition of Australian politics. Anthony Albanese and Jim Chalmers have their hands full as they prepare a budget for an electorate that is pessimistic about the future of the country and the economy. In the leadership stakes, Pauline Hanson has had yet another breakthrough. The One Nation leader now has a higher job approval rating than Anthony Albanese and Angus Taylor. And for the first time in the Essential poll, her right-wing populist party is outperforming the coalition. Joining me to discuss what the numbers tell us is the Executive Director of Essential Media, Peter Lewis. Peter, welcome back. Good to have you back.
Hey, Josh.
So we're recording this on a Wednesday afternoon, and we're chatting very shortly after the Prime Minister to a forum, a meeting, a chamber of mining industry people has, we think, kind of killed off the idea of there being a 25% tax on exports of gas in the May budget. He's saying he won't do anything to undermine existing contracts. Very good timing, because one of the most interesting bits in the poll this month was about Australian support for a gas tax and support for other budget measures. Well, we'll go to those in a minute. But what do Australians think about the gas tax? There's been a huge public campaign for this, a lot of talk about it, Pundit's Politics and David Pocock and this stuff about, you know, mining companies paying less tax and, you know, on the beer excise. What do Australians think about gas tax here, Pete?
It's popular. It's got majority support. So we put a bunch of budget measures, and you're right, we can go through these in excruciating detail later. But just in terms of taxing profits on gas exports, 33% strongly support, 24% somewhat support, very low opposition, 15% or 12%, in total. So, you know, a 55-12 proposition. I think the Prime Minister's right. It's populist. The thing about populism is it's defined by its popularity.
Popularity.
And then the onus is on a leader who doesn't want to be a purely populist leader to explain why they're taking a different course. And obviously that is now the challenge for the PM. I personally think this is the least surprising budget surprise we'll see in this cycle. If people have been watching what's been happening globally, and again, something to go on deeper in a sec, but the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister have been going around to the countries that deliver us fuel, particularly Singapore, Korea, guaranteeing a reciprocal supply of LNG, and the idea that you would throw a recalibration of the value of that into the mix at the time, which is a impending global crisis, would not, I think you might get a short-term sugar hit in saying tax the bloody gas companies, but I don't think that it would be seen as stewardship through what are going to be increasingly stormy waters.
There's a lot of debate about this one topic, and I mean, you know, the way I interpreted the PM's remarks today, and we'll see what actually happens in a couple of weeks on budget night or maybe later, he killed off the idea of there being a tax on exports, but not necessarily cutting off any other potential changes to, like, the PRRT, the petroleum rent resource tax. Who knows if they'll change that or other.
Yeah, he was making the point that there is already a structure in place, right? So I think rather than something new, there might be calibration around that.
Yeah, exactly, right? Or like a windfall tax, something like that.
Worth pointing out that the biggest support base for extending cuts to fuel taxes is people intending to vote One Nation, which, as we know, is an increasingly significant vector.
Yes.
Worth pointing out that the strongest support for taxing profits on gas exports is actually Labor voters at 65%, with less support from coalition voters down at 52%, 60% One Nation. So, again, like, there's majority support for the proposition, but I think in the context of what is going to be a significant global downturn, the Prime Minister's decision is not going to be his defining decision over the next 6 to 12 months.
The populist thing is interesting, and we'll come back to populists and One Nation maybe a little bit later on. But I thought it was really interesting last week, Mark Butler, the Health Minister, Disability Minister, NDIS Minister, explicitly pointed to the fact that he said there was government commission polling on people thinking the NDIS was very important, a critical scheme, obviously it is, but claimed that there were polling numbers showing that Australians thought there was too much money being spent on it, or it was money being wasted or spent in the wrong areas and that sort of thing. So populism, sometimes, you know, the government says, you know, populism's bad. Sometimes when they want to make a change, they can say, oh, the people are behind us. I don't know. How does that work sometimes, Peter?
Well, I think populism is an agenda where the wisdom of the common people dictates and breaks down the duopoly, or, you know, the power of the elites. Now, if you accept that you've got the common person and the elites, which is a sign of a democracy that isn't really functioning very well, polling, or I would argue as someone that does social research and polling for political parties, polling is about testing ideas, getting feedback loops going. It's not about saying, oh, we've got 78% support for this, we better go and do it. It is more understanding where polling fits in to the social contract for change. And I think Butler would have been totally within his rights to get a pulse check of the attitudes towards what is a really significant social scheme, which is also a really significant line item in the budget and a growing one. And again, in ours, there was support restricting NDIS spending. There was support for it. The highest support base there, again, were our friends in One Nation, interestingly, but overall the support for restricting NDIS spending is 51%, 22% opposed. Again, it's really hard when you do polling because they become really crude propositions where there's so much nuance around it. Like the conditional support for reducing spending on the NDIS is building other supports for people with disability.
Of course.
Likewise, you know, the other thing in the budget measures that really stands out for me is while there is more support for reducing tax breaks for property investors than not, it is not majority. It's 46-23 with the others don't know or neutral. Now, that says, and I think most of us reading the tea leaves would think that that is going to be one of the measures to some degree. That's not a slam dunk. That's going to require a fair bit of advocacy from the government to land that one. And even with the generational equity, there's no difference between the age brackets on that one.
I thought that was really interesting. Mm. Yeah, across all the age brackets, there was pretty pretty similar support, 46-47%, no matter how old you were. That was interesting. So we've talked about a couple of budget points there. Obviously, this is the last poll we'll do before the federal budget in the early part of May. Peter, a few really interesting points in the poll this month. People's optimism or maybe lack thereof about the economy, about where the country's going. Bit pessimistic Australians seem to be in this poll. Can you run us through what people think about the economy and where we're going?
Yeah. So we've got a question we go back to. How do you think the economy will look in the next 6 months? Will it improve, stay the same, or get worse? We've got 55% of people now thinking it will get worse. That's 20 points up from a year ago. The other 45% are wrong. Like, so the real challenge for the government is deteriorating economic conditions. I write in my column this week that this is almost the opposite of the pandemic, which was a fast-moving crisis. The virus moved at the speed of jets. The speed of this crisis is the massive oil tankers that go at the speed of a bicycle. There are still ships arriving in Singapore that left before the blockade, so the tail is going to be so long. So my tortured analogy of the week, for those that are interested, is the 1957 classic book by Neville Shute, On the Beach, which was about Australians waiting for the fallout from a ill-judged war in the Middle East reaching Australia, which was the last place on earth where life would survive. So it's pretty dark. But the idea that I was trying to get there is that – the bad things happened, but it is going to take a long time to flow through, and people are still coming to the realization, because no matter what the government does, fuel prices are going to go up, food prices are going to go up. Mm. That's going to cause businesses to employ less people. That's going to mean that there's more of a drain on government services. Like, we are moving into a global slowdown caused by, as the majority of our respondents agree, the foolish attacks on Iran by the US and Israel. And that is going to leave us in the budget in a more perilous position, and I think it's going to leave the Australian economy in slowdown. So the challenge for the government is not to say it's not our fault, but to come up with credible measures that mitigate and also take the moment to ensure that we are not as exposed to these global energy supply chains ever again. And I think, you know, that's going to be part of it as well. But it's really weird, because there's a fair bit of the discourse at the moment, particularly around building sovereign fuel supplies, which isn't going to do anything to mitigate what's about to happen to us.
No, these are like longer term things, aren't they?
Because it's moving so slowly, and it's the sequencing. So, you know, the PM did that address to the nation a month ago.
Yeah.
And everyone thought, oh, that was a bit pedestrian, but actually pedestrian is the pace of the crisis. And so even setting up the sense that there's going to be
something coming down the line,
and it's bad, you know. And so it was interesting. People seem to be up for some of the measures that the government was talking about in terms of, you know, changing the way they use their cars. Like, no one's going to celebrate the rationing of fuel, but I think people see it coming. I think people are going to be reducing their travel where they can. So it is, you know, and again, it's a weird, because we're used, and politics is used, to fast moving crises. Like, the government gets up, they announce there's going to be a lockdown, there, you know, it's all very dramatic.
Mm.
This is pedestrian. And so how do you lead through a slow moving car wreck rather than a fast moving crisis? And that's really going to define the government over the next few years.
I've heard people just talk about this concept as the bubble, like the bubble coming down the hose pipeline, right? It might take a long time for it to get here, but at some point it is going to hit.
Mm-hmm.
Even just, you know, I've done a lot of reporting on the fuel crisis over the last couple of months, and, you know, obviously in the early stages, everyone was panicking about rationing. Oh, you know, Chris Bowen's secret plan to, you know, ban jerry cans and that sort of thing. The demand spiked, you know, monstrously basically overnight. You know, obviously petrol stations ran out of fuel and prices, you know, spiked very highly and that sort of thing. I've been detecting a bit of a not quite surprise. I think people are obviously very happy about it, but in the government, a little tone of surprise that we haven't sort of had more terrible side effects so far. But I think, as you say, Peter, some of the ships that are still arriving had left from the Middle East, right?
So the ships have not even stopped, even though they've been stopped for 6 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. So we're still kind of getting the last of the fuel from the Middle East before the Strait of Hormuz closed. Who knows what the next couple of weeks look like? I think there is concern that this could get a bit worse.
I think what's interesting that Bowen's done is set up those benchmarks of how many days supply and the fuel there are, and
they've been going up.
And to be fair, there is only a certain amount you can actually store, so they're almost maxing out.
Mm.
But those benchmarks, which feel a little bit like, you know, the daily updates on spread and everything back in the pandemic, but if they start dropping those days, people are going to be ready for it. They're going to see it coming. It won't be. So, you know, that's the bit of long-termism that's probably in there at the moment. I think the bigger challenge, I think particularly for Jim Chalmers, who'd really set up this budget as the lodestar of the government's second term, to really, like, this is why Labor's in power. Again, Labor's in power, much as they were in 2007 when the GFC hit, where global realities mug their ambitions. So I think there will still be measures on housing, but I do there is going to be a more constrained environment, I think, for spending on big ticket items. I know that there's still, you know, one other thing, I don't know if you wanted to get to it later, was just the attitudes to the broader energy transition in light of this. And again, I think this is something that will wash through over time.
I think these are really interesting numbers, because people aren't saying move away from fossil fuels. People are actually kind of getting more on board with we should do more on renewables. And this has become a weird kind of like Rorschach test. I keep thinking this, like, no matter, depending where you sit on the political spectrum, the fuel crisis is either we need to double down on get more fuel and get more oil, and we need to set ourselves up with more fossil fuels. And the other side goes, well, maybe fossil fuels aren't the way. And this is actually a really good indicator that, you know, we shouldn't just be the end of a supply chain or dependent on drilling a finite resource out of the ground that we can use once and never again. Maybe we should be looking more at renewables, solar, batteries, hydro.
So let's talk about those numbers. 23% think we should move as quickly as possible to renewables. 38% continue at a steady pace. 9% slow down. And then 20% we should not shift away from coal, oil or gas, and 10% dunno. But where this gets interesting, which might be a segue into our next special subject for this, is that the big outlier here, Australians should not shift away from coal, oil and gas. 5% Labor, 27% Coalition, 0 Greens, thank you that you are voting Green for a reason, and 44% One Nation. So they are absolute outliers when it comes to coal, oil and gas. So I think one of the interesting things as we talk about One Nation is where they are in line with the broader public, and then where they are a long way off the reservation. And this is one where they are outliers. And obviously the real risk for the coalition there is that their people are a bit in the middle.
Yeah. I'll come to that in a second. Yeah. I really do want to, because there's some startling statistics about what people think about Pauline Hanson as the leader of One Nation, specifically when you compare her to Albanese and Angus Taylor. But one last one, Peter, and a bit of a, you know, bigger picture one. Taking into account all these numbers in the poll, right? People are concerned about where the country's heading. People are concerned about the economy. Don't think it's going to get better in the next 6 months. The budget's coming up. People want to cut spending on the NDIS. They want the government to spend more on extending the fuel tax cuts. They want to reduce tax breaks on property investors. They want to increase spending on defence.
Which is an interesting one. I didn't see that coming, but maybe because in such an unstable world, like Richard Miles has got more to take to the Expenditure Review Committee.
When you pull these factors together, I mean, what are the competing things that a Treasurer or a government, Prime Minister, Albanese, Jim Chalmers and so forth, how do they start squaring all these different numbers away about how to pull the budget together?
So I reckon there are three through lines here in this budget. The first are things that are in government's control, which is what they can spend, what they can tax. And I think they've been very clear that constraining NDIS spending and bringing in and stopping spending as much money on tax concessions are going to be at the centre of it. I think then there's going to be things that have been imposed on them, such as the material impact of the global slowdown. So I'm expecting that they're going to have to project for more, for instance, spending on welfare payments and supports and that sort of thing. And then thirdly, there's just that broader call, which you'll see when you go in and have your first read of the budget papers, I assume, which is what is the economic outlook going to be over the next 12 months? Like, look, the market has obviously factored in some of the disruption. So the way markets work is it's all about the future. But I just think that there is no sugarcoating. I can't see a scenario where we are in a period of economic growth over the next couple of years. So that is going to be the other constraint in the way that the budget is framed.
Let's flip a little bit, pivot into some political numbers here. You asked, I think for the first time you asked about Pauline Hanson's job approval as the leader of One Nation. This is not, to be clear, this is not the preferred Prime Minister stakes or anything like that, but do you approve of Pauline Hanson, disapprove of her job as One Nation leader? Similar question for Angus Taylor as leader of the Liberals. Similar question for Albanese as the Prime Minister. What did you find here, Pete? Because I was very, very surprised by some of these numbers.
Yeah, and look, to be clear, the reason we do that is that there's only like preferred prime minister is like a hypothetical because one has the job and the other doesn't. So we've always been, do you approve or disapprove of the job they're doing?
Every time Pauline Hanson's on a media interview, the host, oh, Pauline, what would you do if you were the prime minister? And Pauline, what are you going to do when you're the prime minister? She's 75 seats away from being the prime minister.
Correct.
They got one seat of 150 in the House. And Pauline Hanson, a senator, is in the wrong house of the parliament to be a prime minister. She's never going to be the prime minister. I'm glad we didn't ask, is she the preferred prime minister? But sorry, Pete, to cut you off.
That's a highly coherent outburst, Josh, and I fully concur. Anyway, so do we approve of the job Pauline Hanson is doing as the leader of One Nation? Well, firstly, people say who say they're going to vote for One Nation, which is still at 25%, definitely do. 68% strongly approve, 30% approve, so that's 98%. So tick. Coalition, this is more concerning for the coalition. 14% strongly approve of the job she's doing, 47% approve. That's 61% of coalition voters like the job that Pauline Hanson's doing, and 33% of Labor voters approve, and 21% of you Green voters approve. Now, what that mean might mean different things to different people, but it's obviously reinforcement that this is a real thing. I think it was last month or the month before we asked people, would they consider voting One Nation? And the numbers were quite high as well. So going back to our original thing, populism, popular leadership, is she effective articulating populist propositions? You'd have to say on this, on these numbers, yes. Does she have every bloody pollster, even the people at The Guardian, giving her, you know, a megaphone? I'm sorry,
even
everyone. We are doing that too. But the other number that I thought was interesting this week, which maybe speaks to a little bit of those high numbers, was for the first time since we've polled it on immigration, we've got more people saying it's been generally negative, 45% versus generally positive for the nation, 45-41. Back in April 2019, that was 51 positive, 35 negative. So, and on that one, you would not be surprised to know of the general negative, One Nation is overrepresented at 79%, only 10% thinking immigration is generally positive. Just to compare that, Labor 61-25 positive, and then Coalition 51-42 negative, which again speaks to the wicked. This is almost like a replay of the challenges that the coalition had with the Teals two cycles ago when they got totally smashed on climate, in that between ambition and denial. This time they're in the same place with immigration, and each time, and I thought last week, that fairly tawdry policy that Taylor put forward where he was actively discriminating people based on the cultures they came from and proudly doing so. He's not going to win that, because that's where One Nation is. He's not going to win getting there. And I thought it was interesting as a counterpoint, you know, some of the positions Andrew Hastie's been taking, which is much more don't go on immigration, go on the fact that they're tied in with Trump and Gina Reinhardt. And, you know, there's this weird sort of common messaging opening up in the Farah by-election between people like Hastie and GetUp, who are all focusing on Hanson's links to Reinhardt and Trump rather than trying to fight her on the immigration front.
There's always that thing in politics, right? You talk about, you know, don't reframe the question. Like, if you can't win the question, if you can't beat your opponent on the question, like, make a different question.
The other thing, everyone knows Pauline Hanson. The other thing with Hanson is that over 30 years, she's never voted for pro-worker legislation once. And so there are some real opportunities to define her over the period. But I think the first step is to take her seriously. And if these numbers do nothing but, it is to take her and One Nation seriously, which is different to the normal approach, which has almost been to cancel them out of the political discourse for legitimate reasons. But that's not going to wash it when you've got a majority of Australians approving of the job she's doing.
Josh Butler and Peter Lewis will be right back.
One last one before we sort of start wrapping up, Peter. You've mentioned it a couple of times through our discussion here, but One Nation voters, as you've said a couple of times, are outliers on a couple of these ideas, right? Like, they're a bit more pessimistic on the economy. more likely to blame the government for the fuel crisis, more likely to oppose immigration. Run us through that concept there. Why are One Nation voters, outlying in the way they are on a couple of these points?
I don't know if I can give you a why. I can give you a what, which you've summarised neatly, which is they think things are worse, and I think they're going to be likely to be proven right. They are more likely to be pro-America, pro-Trump, and they're also more likely to be suspicious of big corporations and wanting government to stand up there. So there's a few different things that I think the challenge over the next period is just, and the gift, if there is a gift in One Nation reaching 25%, it gives us a large enough sample to really start looking at, particularly where the contradictions are and where they are in lockstep with the general mood and when they're, where they're separate. And that is the job of politics. But, a populist party is hard. Going back to that original point, populism is a reaction to perceptions the elites are not listening to people. Mm. And they will only intensify in a time of economic downturn, which will not be caused by anything that the Albanese government's done, but they will be the ones that are in power at that point. So for Labor, the challenge is to bring things like a future made in Australia to life. It's to find ways of materially intervening to ease pressure on those that are feeling the hardships of a global downturn the most. And I think rather than a sweeping reform agenda, that's really going to define this next term in government.
I think we've come to the end of our time, Peter. As always, such a pleasure unpacking this. This is a really dense and heavy poll this week.
Yeah, sorry about that. We'll do some jokes next week.
Peter, thank you as always. We'll see you again next month.
Good on you, Josh.
Thanks for joining us today. Tomorrow on Australian Politics, political editor Tom McElroy speaks with former Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria. The executive producer was Alison Chan. I'm Josh Butler. See you next time.